Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The United States of Europe, for better or for worse, David Cameron openly talks of leaving the EU this week. Also, getting to the root of the financial crisis, London-based Islamic think tank Global Vision 2000 has been doing some thought-provoking excavations. And as ever, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But first, we take a look at a chap called John McDonnell. He was the Labour leadership candidate 2 years ago at the time of the resignation of Gordon Brown, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Can you tell us, he didn't win. In fact, he ended up not even standing in the final round of the Labour leadership contest. Why was that? Diane Abbott came and stood in instead of him round.
I think... he knew that he wasn't going to get enough support, and if he stood against Diane Abbott, he would probably have undermined her bid to be Labour leader. But neither of them had much chance of being Labour leader. They represent the kind of left wing of the party, and both of them will have been standing in the leadership election just to test the water and see how strong the left of the party still is. They wouldn't have expected to win, either of them, I don't suppose.
I mean, how were they politically lined up with people like Robin Cook, who was Foreign Secretary, resigned on principle?
Robin Cook would have been a much stronger candidate had he been alive. John McDonnell is, I think I'm correct in saying at the moment, he's the coordinator of the campaign group of Labour MPs, which makes up about 20 Labour MPs, I believe. And they are what you might call the hard left of the party, just as, you know, all parties have a left wing and a right wing. John McDonnell at the moment is the standard bearer for the what's called the hard left. I mean, I don't suppose he'd see himself as a hard man. He'd see himself as a man who's very soft on the poor and the downtrodden. But I mean, he was never a mainstream candidate who was likely to win.
Anyway, a few weeks ago I had the chance to meet up with John McDonnell and spent a while really going through as many of the current issues as possible, including really looking at the relationship between the royal family and the government, because we've had the unprecedented situation, Martin, this week, haven't we, with the Queen. In fact, apparently this hasn't happened for 500-600 years, with the Queen actually sitting in on a cabinet meeting. Now, this does sort of tear apart the idea that there's somehow complete independence between the Queen and the government, and that the Queen is sort of there to attract tourists. She's obviously quite interested in what's going on in government too.
I can imagine that the Queen was probably fairly bored to be going to sitting in a cabinet meeting. I mean, I understand one of the requests she made is, the only request she made was, can future Queen speeches be a little shorter, please? Amen to that. I mean, this is all constitutional dancing around the place. I don't think it's got the real significance. The real power structure is not when the Queen visits the cabinet. It's to do with bankers and industrialists and press barons.
But she does have quite a lot of power, doesn't she? For example, in appointing justices, that kind of thing.
She's not powerless, but she's not the focal point of the real string pulling.
Anyway, we're kind of going off a bit of a tangent there. Yeah. But anyway, here is John McDonnell MP, who stood to be Labour leader 2 years ago.
I'm John McDonnell. I'm a Labour MP for Hayes and Harlington on the western edge of London, a multicultural working class constituency. And I'm also Secretary of the NUJ Parliamentary Group in Parliament. And what does One Nation mean? Well, I think what it seemed to mean to Ed Miliband was that whereas the Conservatives are dividing our country, the Labour Party needs to bring it together. I have no problems with that. What I do have a problem with, though, is that this doesn't reflect the reality of what's happening within our community at the moment, because we're not all in this together. In my constituency, and I don't want to know what it's like in your area, but I've got people coming to my office door who've lost all benefits for the slightest reason. A lot of people with disabilities, particularly people with mental health issues, who've lost all benefits. We run a food bank through our local churches and religious groups, but we also give out food from my office now. People have got so desperate. I've got young people now who have been on the dole for a long period of time, out of work, can't get jobs, can't get back into training either because they've apprenticeships, despite what the government's saying, are not available to them. Intimidated about going to university because of the high cost of tuition fees. And we've got a real economic crisis on our hands. I've also got the worst housing crisis I've ever had in my constituency since the Second World War, where people are living in appalling slum conditions with no prospect of a decent roof over their heads. And there's no wonder children are out on the streets if you're living five or six in a family to in a two-bedroom flat. So my problem with the One Nation is that at the moment we're not in a One Nation. It is a 1% that is controlling most of the wealth of our country, and the 99% who actually are suffering as a result of the policies this government is pursuing.
But it's a coalition government, isn't surely Ed Miliband is putting a different vision. He's saying that what we need is to really go back to the roots of the working class movements in Britain, to the Labour Party, and he's mentioned some of the historical figures like Disraeli as well, and he's saying actually what Labour's vision is very different to all this.
Well, interesting that you mentioned Disraeli, because Disraeli's concept of one nation wasn't bringing everyone together, it was actually saying everyone should be in their place.
Tell us a bit about Disraeli. Many people have never heard of him.
Well, Disraeli is an interesting character. He arrived in British politics always as something, as a phenomenon, largely because of his oratory and his positioning, and he rose to what he called the top of the greasy pole in doing various deals, etc. And he made this announcement. He was Jewish, so he was something of an outsider within British politics and was looked upon as that. And so he made a sort of a strategic decision that the way in which he could assume leadership of politics in this country was to somehow appeal to stabilise the country by saying we're all one nation. What that didn't reflect was that at the very time he was saying that, we had children down mines. We had people working 12 to 15-hour days. People were working 6 days and some days 7 days a week. We had appalling slum conditions. He had no understanding of what most ordinary working people in this country were experiencing. So the whole concept of One Nation for Disraeli was to try and destabilise what was effectively class rule. What then happened was, with the rise of trade unions and eventually the development of the Labour Party, we had another vision of society being put forward, which was genuinely One Nation, which we're all equal. That we all contribute together, that we all need a decent roof over our heads, a decent education for our children, we want also treatment if our families are sick, and therefore we elected a Labour government which put in place the welfare state. Now, David Cameron claimed he was a One Nation Tory, and now he's taken apart the welfare state bit by bit, dismantling all the gains that working people in this country have gained over the last century and a half. I'm hoping that what Ed Miliband is now saying by One Nation is not the One Nation of Disraeli, but the One Nation of Clem Attlee, who established the the first Labour Prime Minister after the Second World War, who established the welfare state. And I'm hoping what he's saying by One Nation is actually what we're going to do is redistribute wealth in this country, take it out of the hands of the rich and the corporations, make them pay their taxes, and invest that money in rebuilding our society. So we build the homes that we need. We ensure that our children can stay on to education in university without the burden of tuition fees. We give a guarantee to every young person of a job or training or university. And in that way, we can genuinely rebuild our society, and it's a one nation based upon equality. But it can't be a one nation of paper over the cracks of what's happening at the moment. At the moment, the wealthy in this country and the corporations are not paying their taxes. And if Ed Miliband now wants to address the problems that our country faces, one of the things that we've got to say is the £150 billion a year that's not paid by the corporations and the wealthy has to be paid. So we introduce a wealth tax. We introduce a financial transaction tax on the speculators in the city, a land value tax on the developers who are speculating on the development of land. And in that way, we take the resources out of the hands of the wealthy and we put them to productive use within our community. That's the sort of one nation I'm hoping Ed Miliband is arguing for.
We've got a big problem though, haven't we? Because in the opinion polls, the public don't like Ed Miliband. They don't really support him. In fact, even incumbent Prime Minister David Cameron seems to have more support from the public than your leader. So what on earth hope do you have at the next election?
That's why I think we've got to go away from this sort of glamour model version of politics. I think we've got to make sure that when Ed Miliband gets up to speak, rather than have generalities about one nation, he really spells out what that means. So in other words, we win it on the basis of ideas, not on this idea that the next Prime Minister will be elected as some in some beauty pageant or beauty queen contest. If his speeches from here on in spell out in detail, this is what we're going to do to address each of the problems that our country and every family is facing in this country, I think we'll win the election. But if we allow it to be dragged down into, you know, who looks better or who can talk better or who dresses better, because that's what a lot of this image consultancy is all about, I think we degrade politics in this country. I'll just give one example. One of the issues that came up over the last week has been about the West Coast line in terms of the railways. Collapsed again because of the franchise problem. Well, the franchising issue is inherent in the privatised railway system. If Ed Miliband had said, look, we're going to bring rail back into public ownership and solve these problems that way, which is supported in every opinion poll I've ever seen over the last 10 years, I think that would have been immensely popular. And it would have demonstrated that there's substance to his speech about one nation rather than just some glib phrase.
But isn't he really hedging his bets by being keeping his options open and not being too specific before a general election?
That's the argument. The argument that most of his advisers have put to him and all the spin doctors is don't be too specific, work on the level of generalities, and then we'll ride into the general election and hopefully that people's revulsion of the Tories will get us into power. I don't think that works. I think people want to know what you stand for, and they'll want to know how you're addressing each of their individual concerns. So when a family comes into my constituency office who are living in a slum, they'll want to know, can I, if Labour goes back into power, promise them a house, a decent house with a garden, enough for their children, a sufficient size for their children to have a room of their own. We've got to promise things like that, and we've got to demonstrate in detail how we can deliver that. So the level of generality won't work, and every time we've tried that and we go into a general election without clarity on the policies that we're going to implement, we get torn apart.
Now, you're also Secretary of the National Union of Journalists Parliamentary Group. It's been a busy year, I imagine, for you, what with the Leveson inquiry. What's your view of, particularly of the remit of Leveson and whether he was the right man for the job? Because many people have pointed out that Lord Leveson actually was quite a close family friend, went to parties with the Murdoch family. And so you've obviously engaged with that process, but how do you think it's worked? What's it meant for you?
I've been sceptical from the beginning about the appointment of Leveson, but we'll give him his opportunity and we'll see what he comes out with. Certainly what's been interesting at the inquiry itself has been the ability of individual lawyers and others to argue their case and to question people like Murdoch. And we've seen the questioning by John Hendy on behalf of the National Journalists of Rupert Murdoch, where, to be frank, Rupert Murdoch had no answers to what happened in News International. Or if he did have the answers, he wasn't forthcoming about what really happened. And I think the QC who was interrogating him there made Murdoch look either shady or a fool. So I'm hoping from Leveson what we'll get is a recognition of just how degraded our media was as a result of the influence of Murdoch, come forward with real proposals about how we can reform them. One of the key issues for me as Secretary of the NUJ Group in Parliament has been, we've been arguing now under the last government and under this for nearly 10 years now, that a journalist should have in their contract, written in law as well, a conscience clause, so that if any employer, any editor tries to instruct them to do something illegal or immoral, that they can actually say no, and then they cannot be disciplined or dismissed as a result of that, and that's upheld in law. Now, the last government rejected that. I think they made a mistake. We've raised it again in Parliament, and we've raised it the Leveson inquiry, and I think that could be one reform that will strengthen the media in this country and ensure that we have quality journalism rather than the degradation of journalism that took place at News International.
What about the process, though? Because this kind of Leveson inquiry is quite a new thing. It's almost as if it's made for television. It's not the old-fashioned style, what used to be things like royal commissions or public inquiries into these sorts of incidents.
No, that's true. There's been an openness and transparency about Leveson, which has been quite helpful. But at the same time, it has been a bit of a media circus as well. It's very difficult getting the balance on all of that. The key issue, though, is Leveson will report report. We'll see what that report is like. What then happens, though, is the absolute critical point. Will the government then introduce legislation? And the real debate will be around what legislation that the government brings forward. I think it inevitably must do. Whoever's in government at that time will have to legislate. But I'm just hoping that they don't ignore this issue about the protection of the rights of journalists in law, the conscience clause, because I think that's a foundation stone of quality journalism in this country. And a foundation stone eventually of a free press, and therefore a foundation stone of democracy.
One of the other problems, of course, is one of the things that almost precipitated the business with Jeremy Hunt is this whole business of ownership and how much one person or one group is able to own. That, so it seems to be all going in the wrong direction, John. Fewer owners, fewer managers, fewer editors, which means less plurality in our media.
As Secretary of the NUJ Group in Parliament, I was the first to raise the issue of Murdoch as bid for B Sky B. And it wasn't just about Murdoch himself, it was about any individual or any powerful corporation taking over another part of the media and forming effectively almost a monopoly, or if not a monopoly, a virtual cartel. As soon as that happens, it's like in any sector, as soon as you allow a monopoly to occur, freedom of choice then goes, and what you effectively have is the voice of a particular interest. Now, I'm hoping Leveson will make some recommendations about the monopolisation of the press, and I doubt if he will, because it didn't seem to focus on his mind, but that will come out of the debate after Leveson. It does mean that what we've got to do now is look again at what restrictions and regulation that we require to make sure that no monopoly can be formed, cartels can't be formed in that way, but also there's more democratic access to the media itself. And that may look at new models of ownership of the media, new models of intervention in the media. We argue for a long period of time about the role for cooperatives within the media itself, cooperatives representing the journalists themselves, but also the consumer, the people who receive the news. So they look at, there's opportunities now, I think, of opening up this debate. It may require, if we believe in a healthy democracy, it might require state funding to get some of these new models off the ground. If that is the case, I support it.
The situation in Britain, though, isn't quite as bad as it is in some countries like Somalia, for example.
We've had a debate recently in Parliament. Don Foster, the MP, who's one of the members of the NUJ parliamentary group, raised the debate, and a number of us intervened in that discussion. And we exemplified the attacks on journalists right there across the world over the last decade, where literally hundreds of journalists have been attacked and many of them murdered and killed. Somalia is one example where journalists have been butchered, but we've seen recently the arrests and attacks on journalists in the Gambia. We've seen the murder of journalists in Russia, simply to silence them because they're reporting the truth, and they're reporting exposés, particularly of what's happening within government within those countries. There is international regulations, there's international law protecting journalists and protecting the free press. The problem is many governments act with almost impunity, and leaders get away with almost immunity as a result. Well, we've been saying to the UK government that we want the UK now to lead as a shining example in raising these matters at the UN and in other international bodies, so that the message goes out to any country or any leader of a country that if they attack journalists and they try to in any way suppress the free press, that they be isolated in the world and exposed on the international stage.
We had a fascinating news story the other week where the BBC got very embarrassed because their royal correspondent said that the Queen phoned up David Plunkett and asked him what he could do to get Abu Hamza arrested, because there must surely be a law somewhere that he'd broken. Now, we are told that the Queen is very sort of aloof and distant from politics. Does this disturb you, this story? And if so, you know, what does it teach us about the way power really works in Britain?
If the royal family are going to take political positions and intervene in the political process, that has to be open and transparent. It can't be hidden away. There can't be any conventions that say that there should be no reporting of what the royal family, members of the royal family, are doing if they intervene in politics. If they don't want to be reported, well, they shouldn't intervene. It's as simple as that. Otherwise, we're back to almost a 17th century concept of politics where the royalty can do what they want and are unaccountable to no one. Well, we established the constitutional settlement in the 17th century that actually ensured that no one was unaccountable in British politics. So therefore I have to say, you know, if the Queen is upset about the reporting of her conversations with people on political matters, she should either not intervene politically, or if she does intervene politically, well, that has to be open and transparent, and therefore she'll be held to account for her statements.
Do you yourself wonder what the Queen's position is on other matters, things like the privatisation of the police, the privatisation of the probation service, that kind of thing?
I'm not interested in the Queen's views unless she uses those views and exerts influence on the political process. If she's seeking to influence a Prime Minister or a Minister, I want to know how she's done that, what she's said, and what influence that's had, because it's totally undemocratic. We elect a government, we elect MPs to hold that government to account, and if the Queen is, or any member of the royal family, is to have a political role, therefore they should be held to account in some way.
I wonder how she's going to be held to account for this one.
Well, she's not at the moment, is she, apart from by the public exposure of what's happening, and I hope that she and her other members of the royal family will learn some lessons from that. Please don't interfere in politics, but if you do, do it openly and transparently so that at least we know what you're saying.
Yeah, and of course we're not allowed to know what's being said every Wednesday between David Cameron and the Queen.
No, and if it is more than just a conversation with no effect whatsoever, if it is having some influence on the Prime Minister, well, again, we should know. Those meetings should be minuted and those minutes should be published.
Also, the Bullingdon Club seems to feature quite heavily in the Cabinet. Also, the various other figures have come out, and Boris Johnson outed David Dimbleby on live on Question Time a few months ago, as well as being in this club. Do you think it's a bit peculiar that this little club of lads from Oxford who engaged in things like raucous drinking, smashing up pubs, and then they'd send George Osborne around the next day with a chequebook to sort of pay for any damage done, that these people are now running the country?
Look, these are a large number of rich kids who behave badly at times, and again, it's worthwhile having that exposed, but to be frank, I'm not bothered about how much they drunk and the trivial behaviour like that. But what I am bothered about is that here we have a return of an elite within society. We thought we were developing a democratic society in which most people recognised that we were equal and that everyone had equal rights and that we were trying to establish everyone having at least a right to a decent living, a decent roof over their heads, access to a decent education and health service and all the rest. And what this small elite group of the Bullingdon Club are doing is what Nye Bevan used to call class warfare, which is basically on behalf of their class they're stripping out and tearing up every gain that our class of working people have gained over the last 150 years. They're tearing up the welfare state, they're destroying our health service, they're privatizing it. So this little group of youthful drunks have now transmogrified into what is a very efficient clique working together to destroy the society that we created from struggles of working class people over decades, if not centuries. That's the most dangerous element of it.
What about the links between the media, though? Because we've got John Ford, the leader writer from the Financial Times, we've got David Dimbleby, and possibly others, you know, from the Bullingdon Club, with this very close link, historic link, back to people like Cameron and Osborne.
Well, it just shows you how unequal our society is and how little distance we've come in making it equal. Because, in effect, what we have now is a small elite group in government, in the media, mixing at the same dinner party circles, largely determining what we hear and what we read. And I think that's dangerous for democracy and dangerous for society. But it's come as a shock to most people, because we thought we were moving towards a more egalitarian form of society. But in effect, what's happening is there's a reinstatement of a very rigid class system by this small elite group within the Bullingdon Club that is exerting so much influence. As it's exposed, though, people recoil from it, and I think it will eventually result in certainly this government being removed from power, but it also will, I think, excite the debate about how we create a more equal society, and that is about redistribution of wealth and power within our society.
That was the Labour MP for Hayes and Harlingdon, John McDonnell, speaking to me a few weeks ago before the announcement of the Leveson report. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I mean, he's kind of coming from the same part of the Labour Party as you, I guess, isn't he?
Pretty much, yeah.
One of his things he's saying there is he's talking about the current leadership, and it's, I mean, I was steering him really towards talking about the Bullingdon Club, because it is rather worrying that these guys who were essentially some of the worst thugs and bullies at Oxford, I mean, they were going around smashing up bars and places like this, are now running the Conservative Party. I mean, including people, not just running the Conservative Party, but we're talking about leader writer for the Financial Times, I think is it John Ford. We're talking about also David Dimbleby, who chairs BBC Question Time on a Thursday, is also part of this Bullingdon Club, as well as other, you know, people who are running hedge funds and in city, and also Nat Rothschild.
Well, yes, and of course, you know, this is part of the political knockabout of today's discussions, is, you know, the social origins of the leaders and so on. I'd prefer to focus on the actual policies being pursued rather than who's pursuing them. I mean, I went to Oxford, but I wasn't a member of the Bullingdon Club. I couldn't be a member of the Bullingdon Club. You have to go to Eton to be a member of the Bullingdon Club. And I think that's the fundamental point, is that the current leadership of the country is being drawn from a social group, which it was traditionally drawn from, it has to be said. You know, if you go back 50 or 60 years, it would be no surprise that these people were the Conservative cabinet. And I think, in a way, as I said earlier in the last hour, ruling classes tend to rule. No surprises there.
Well, the oldest, longest-serving member of the Conservative Party, Harry Beckhoff, 98 years of age, 84 years in the party, still with us. What do you make of this leadership? I mean, we've got both Osborne and Cameron from the Bullingdon Club, and they're sort of surrounded in the city and in much of the mainstream media by their old friends from Oxford and Eton.
I think it's a joke.
What do you mean by that?
Well, they think they're born to rule. And because they think they have that situation in hand, they can play about as much as they like. And that's why they are noted playboys at school and university. It's only afterwards that they go for the real jobs. But they haven't changed themselves in the meantime, and some of the old bully boy attitude still there. They haven't got the experience of life and the tradition of doing something definite in the way of a job before taking over a leadership. They're there without experience, and it's really a very sad story.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Right, Martin Summers and I will take a little tour of some of the world's hotspots now. Aircraft carriers, Martin, in the Mediterranean this week.
Yes, until earlier in the week, there were three US aircraft carriers in the Eastern Mediterranean. This week, about on Wednesday, I think it was, on Tuesday, two of those aircraft carriers, they've been there since the beginning of December, they were withdrawn from deployment in the Eastern Mediterranean. And some people have been...
So what, moved to the Western Mediterranean?
Well, basically they've been sent back home to the US to be refitted, or the story being given is that they've been sent away because they're not needed, and they need various repairs to be carried out to them.
Well, this is surely good news. It means less tension in the Middle East if there's less military hardware hanging around.
There's a number of interpretations of this current in the international media. Of course, this is not the sort of thing that you're going to find on the BBC or whatever. It's Bristol Community Radio covers these stories, and the international press like Russia Today. I think they've been removed. There's two possible explanations. It's possibly due to the fact that Obama now wants to lower tensions over Syria, so by removing these two aircraft carriers, and of course they've got Marines on the aircraft carriers and so on, ready for an intervention in Syria. But by removing these two aircraft carriers, he's kind of sending a signal to the Russians and to the Syrians that he wants to take everything down a gear, and that he's prepared to negotiate in some shape or form. But other people have suggested, and it's been covered in various parts of the international media, that what also happened last week was that the Russians supplied the Syrians with the Iskander missile, or a variety of these missiles, which are basically designed to kill aircraft carriers. So these withdrawal of
the
two
aircraft... Last week you were saying they're designed to kill Patriot missiles.
They're designed to kill virtually anything. They're the highest... They're the Russians' top top conventional missile, and up to now they've not wanted to deploy them to the Syrians because the Syrians are allies. But basically, this is the top kit the Russians have got.
So you just stick a target in, you say right,
yeah,
destroy,
and
that.
It's virtually impossible to stop them. And that may explain why these aircraft carriers have been removed, because basically these missiles cancel them out and could sink the aircraft carriers. And that's another thing that's
possible. Let's not forget that there'd be thousands of Marines on those
indeed
aircraft carriers.
Well, I mean, this is also true of the standoff with Iran. If the Iranians were supplied with these Russian level and Chinese silkworm missiles, have also been developed over the last 20-30 years, because of course the US have basically got 30 odd aircraft carriers and nobody else has got any to speak of. We've got one, the French
with no planes,
well, yes, I mean we're not real players. The Chinese have got one which they just started, which they bought from the Ukrainians. The Russians have got two. One is in Tartus in the Eastern Mediterranean, the other is actually in the Caribbean. So their second aircraft carrier is up close to the US so that they can see them, and we can get you if we want to. But of course both the Chinese and the Russian navies realised that they could never compete building aircraft carriers to compete with the US. So what they've done, quite intelligently, is produce missiles that kill aircraft carriers. And of course these Iskander missiles are very much cheaper than an aircraft carrier. So you can produce hundreds of them, and each one of them.
So are you saying essentially these aircraft carriers are kind of old technology? It's a bit like trying to use a biplane in the Second World War.
Yeah, I mean, what tends to happen, as Harry will know, is that generals tend to fight the last war. So aircraft carriers were absolutely decisive in World War II, and the US have developed an overall preponderance in aircraft carriers. And of course their opponents, who can't compete in aircraft carriers, have developed these missiles which take out aircraft carriers. So a bit like, the English longbowmen taking down the French mounted knight, a cheap technology which shoots the horse, and that's the end of that. And of course that may in fact be a positive sign, because it means that neither side can actually start a full-scale confrontation without consequences, and that tends to lead to people talking in a more reasonable tone of voice, because a deal needs to be done to end the fighting, obviously, rather than an outright, rather than an outright victory from one side or the
other. There's a point. You see, this may be a hidden purpose lying behind the withdrawal of those ships. There is, I understand, something of an understanding with Russia at the moment, whereby Russia feels that she's going to have to go into Syria.
Yeah.
Now, that gives me the thought of a possible entente between them all as to what action they'll all take in order to settle Syria in one go.
Yeah.
Now, how that reflects upon Iran is a different story. That's what I'm wondering about.
I think that's right, and I think the Iranians, of course, are allies of the current regime in Syria, as is the regime in Iraq and the regime in Lebanon. So that Assad is not entirely isolated. I think what we really need to see, and the Russians have been saying this all along, is look, you lean on your protégés to draw back, and we will lean on our protégés to draw back, which is how things were run during the Cold War.
Yeah.
And I think getting back, it sounds a bit counterintuitive, getting back to the stability of the Cold War would be better than having a very unpredictable confrontation develop, which nobody can control the outcome of. And it doesn't make a lot of sense from the interests of... some deal will have to be done over Syria.
That's
in
right.
View.
That's, I think, is why those two carriers are withdrawn. Yep. A deal is being done under the surface.
Well, one hopes so, because otherwise the possibility of an outright confrontation, for example, a sinking of a couple of those aircraft carriers with, 10,000 guys on each aircraft carrier, that doesn't strike me as a very good idea at all.
They don't want a real battle.
Well, Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, we haven't quite totally finished talking about the EU with Harry Beckhoff yet, because I'm going to put a couple of points to you now, Harry, about the European Union. We've seen some big changes with the Germans this year. It's the first time since World War II that Germany has said that our army will start to operate outside Germany. This was back in August, September this year. The German army has been only able to operate within Germany up until that time. It's now becoming much more part of the NATO forces in various parts of the world, possibly including Afghanistan, certainly in part of NATO exercises in the Middle East, this kind of thing.
There's another reason for it. The new Minister of War in Germany decided that the system whereby since the end of the last war, Germans had only a voluntary armed service was going to be changed. And instead of a voluntary one, they have now a professional army. It may be against the law, but that's what they're doing. So the Germans have not only a professional setup, Bundeswehr, but they also now can operate outside Germany, which means that Germany is thumbing her nose at the rest of Europe and saying, we're strong enough to take on any of you anywhere, anytime. And they are.
Well, one of the other things that came out of the time...
We're reducing arms, they're increasing.
Well, one of the other things that came out of the time of this announcement was that actually the Germans have a very large drone program, which hadn't actually been revealed until then. Very high technology drones that they've developed themselves. Mark Martin, you know, you were on Russia Today this week speaking about the Time magazine endorsing Obama as the man of the year. Now, this is incredible, since he's been quite open, it's been open this year now, that he's got this kill list. He sits down with his generals every year, every week, once a week, on a nice comfy sofa, and says, right, you can kill this person, anywhere, yeah, virtually anywhere in Pakistan, yeah, places like Yemen, etc., by using drones. This is a way of getting round, it seems to me, the old rendition system, where people have to be kidnapped and then secretly taken to a secret prison somewhere. Now, they're not even bothering with that, they're just killing them from the skies.
Well, that's been going on for quite a while, and the British are also implicated in drone strikes, as well as and the Germans possibly as well. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we are not at war with Pakistan, and the Pakistani government, which is an elected government, has been saying all along, will you please stop sending your drones over here, because A, 90% of the people you're killing are completely innocent. One of the things they're talking about is double tapping. So they go and take out what they claim is a militant. You can be a militant just for having a weapon. And don't forget that in Northwest Frontier Province of Pakistan, everybody has a weapon. So everybody's a target.
Every child over 10.
Yeah, so everybody's a target. But the point is, when people then come to help, when there's been a drone strike, people come, you know, the first responders come in with stretchers and what have you, then a second strike comes in and hits them. And I think that's what's causing particular bitterness on the ground in Pakistan.
But Harry,
but the fact of the matter is, this is all illegal.
Surely,
because
Harry,
there is no state of war between us.
This kind of thing surely is against international law, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what can be done?
So, America starts with the drones and begins to wipe out important enemies. It doesn't stop there. The British have a go at the drones. The Germans have a go. Do you think the Chinese won't be having a go? There'll now be a big exercise all round on drones. But drones can only be used for a certain select purpose. And if this goes on, there's going to be a hell of a row between them. Because it can lead much further than they intend. The idea of a drone is they can just pick out the target here and there. But when everybody's at it, it begins to wax a bit stronger all the time.
Now, I know there was something I read very briefly yesterday. One of the first people who's been involved in these drone killings in the United States,
yes,
has decided to actually come out and say and give their story, really, just as a confession in a way, holding their hands up and saying, I have been killing people remotely in a, yes, US airbase using drones, and I think it's an appalling state of affairs, and talking to the general public
about
it.
That's because they've been found out.
Okay, one final point to do with Europe and drones. Well, this one not really with drones, but Britain will be expected to plan national defence with the rest of the European Union after David Cameron agreed to accelerate joint military operations under a deal reached in Brussels on the 15th of December. Leaders of all 27 EU countries promised to strengthen Europe's ability to deploy troops rapidly and effectively in any future crisis. Well, this is one solution, Harry, isn't it, to the depletion of the British armed forces, is we're going to have to go in with our European friends.
They've certainly put the cat amongst the pigeons. Can you imagine the leaders of British forces being faced for the first time in history with having to knuckle under to a European army, most likely led by a German? There's all hell going on in Parliament, I'm absolutely certain, at this very moment, because Cameron has more or less given his assent to a situation which is anathema to the British Armed Forces. That's the situation.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, now on to a subject a little bit closer to home, and today is Doomsday, if you believe the prophecies of the Mayans, although it might just simply be something that's been put out by NATO intelligence in Brussels for the last 10 years. No one's really quite sure. But one thing's for sure, there's going to be some partying here in Bristol. We had a very sad story about squatters last week who'd taken over a bar quite legally, it seems, in the city centre, and then were released without charge, not allowing, being allowed to do their political meeting. The councillor, Green councillor for Ashley Ward, Gus Hoyt, was rather disappointed because he was hoping to attend their political meeting, which was then evicted by the police. But we've heard now that the five people have been released without charge and bailed to appear in the new year, possibly maybe charged with abstraction of electricity, which is very difficult to get, pay your electricity bill within 6 hours of moving into a building. But anyway, there is another group of squatters. They're over at Old Hallows Hall in Easton, and they're having a party tonight, starting at 7 o'clock, costing £5 to £7. We don't usually advertise things that you have to pay for here on this programme, but we'll make an exception. And here now is Tony Cripps from that organisation, who are really kind of sprung out of the Occupy movement.
I'm Tony Cripps. We're stood in All Hallows Hall, or the Phoenix Theatre here in Easton in Bristol, and it's a place that was derelict for 7 years. It was burnt down three times. We came in here in August as squatters and spent a month cleaning the place up because we felt that it was such a waste, and you know, it was a place that the community desperately needs with all the cutbacks and closures and things, and bringing it back to a state where the community can once again use it.
Well, that's great, but I can remember seeing you at the Occupy site on the College Green, Tony. I mean, how have you come from there to here?
During the process of College Green, we had regular meetings with the council, with Barbara Jenk and her entourage. On one occasion, we actually asked the council if they would be prepared to give us, or at least give us a short list on a building or buildings which we knew were derelict and lying empty, and some have been lying empty for years and years. We said, basically, we come up with the idea and said, look, we know that you've got over 330 empty commercial properties in and around Bristol. Why don't you allow us to take one of those properties on a short-term lease and work on it and offer it to the community again as a community centre? They said no. It was a stupid answer, really. They actually come back and said no, because if we do it for you, we'll have to do it for everybody. Silly answer. So anyway, we decided, as a kind of continuation of Occupy, although it's changed dramatically, we now know what we're about here in this place. We decided, okay, you won't help us, we'll help ourselves, and we'll help the community, and that's what we're all about. So we took this place. The owners came along after about a month, Group 22 Property Development Company, owned by a bloke called Mr. Nick Bracey. They came along, wanted us out. We invited them in to have a look at what we're doing, and it just blew their heads away, basically. They said, we haven't come across anybody like you.
I can tell you why he's nice, and that's because you're doing his place up for him for free.
Well, of course we are, although this is costing us £700 a month in rent.
So you're paying rent now, isn't that sort of selling out?
No. It was not selling out at all, Tony. I mean, what we're doing is we're paying rent to make sure that this place is secure, and to make sure that we're not in a position whereby we can get kicked out at any time. It gives off security, it gives the community security.
But you're working to do his place up for him, and surely he should be paying you.
Well, we've got an option to buy as well, and in July we are going to start the process of buying the place off of him. He's agreed to that.
Can I ask how much? Because it's a big place. I would imagine you're talking hundreds of thousands of pounds.
Yeah, it's quite a lot of money. I won't go into the actual figures right now.
Well, I'm going to guess £500,000.
You're wrong, but it's not far off the mark, that's all I can say. But yeah, we're looking towards buying this place. We think it's realistic. We think that this offers a fantastic opportunity. Easton hasn't got anything like this. It used to have, as you can see, in 1912 this place was built as a kind of community hall.
But it's got the community centre.
Yeah, well, run by the council. So that's very restricted in what it can offer. Here, Tony, as you can see, we've got a full stage. We're hoping to run theatre school here for the community, film school, radio school. So we're going to be dragging all of you lot into it as well. Like,
yeah, the only thing is, of course, you've got local residents here. You know, if you've got big loud concerts going on, they're not going to like it at all, are they?
Well, the idea about this place is it's not going to be a rave house. We've decided that right from the beginning. It will not be a free party house. This is somewhere where we would like a little bit of class, a little bit of culture, and we'd like to have everybody come in and give their ideas and try and incorporate all of those ideas into what we're doing.
Now, you've come with ideals from the College Green and Occupy. How are you actually going to run it, though? Because, you know, you've got to be organised, but then maybe you want to be, you know, democratic and let everyone have a say. That's not easy to get those two together, is it?
It's not, as we found out on College Green. However, because this place is a private, it's not open to the public as College Green was. You can't just walk in and open a can of beer and do what you want. Here we've got an element of control, and one of the things we came away from College Green with was a deep knowledge that, like, you know, in certain areas autonomy doesn't actually work. There has to be some level of control, otherwise it all goes pear-shaped. This is what this place gives us the opportunity to do, to not to be control freaks or anything, but to be able to control it in a way whereby it's not just mayhemic. We can control it, and we can actually run a business and it can look after itself.
Well, there's about 20 people beavering away doing various things. How long till it's all finished, do you think?
Well, we've got the doomsday machine on. That's at 8 o'clock, and if you have a look around the place now, you can see that, you know, most people would look at it and go, there's no way this is going to be ready for tomorrow night. But one of the things that the people of Occupy have always shown is that it doesn't matter how far you think we've got to go, come that time we'll be there. We've also formed a co-op. We're all the All Hallows Community Co-op, and the four directors of that. And eventually it'll be handed on to other people. None of the people here at the moment will be able to make any personal kind of profit out of this. This is all literally for the community.
I'm Del. Tonight we've got the Doomsday Machine. We're bringing the apocalypse to Easton. We've got a couple of bands. We've got a nice, good local punky grunge band on first called Three Little Devils. Then we've got a hip-hop swing band who are also a local Bristol band called Immigrant Swing. And then we've also got BCFM local Low Dose. He's going to be doing some stuff for us.
So yeah. Do you think you're going to make it through to midnight?
We're going to have to see how it goes. Basically, if we can deactivate the Doomsday Machine, we might be in with a chance, but it's not looking promising. We've also got Apocalyptic AV from Lumen, who are an amazing audiovisual outfit, and Grand Finale, which is Solid Steel's DJ Chiba. He's doing us a one-off special Apocalyptic Doomsday AV set to end the world, so make sure you catch that. It's totally unique, and it's a once-only performance.
Okay.
It's £7 on the door and tickets. It's going to be a big playground of fun.
Well, that is tonight. That's taking place at All Hallows Hall, All Hallows Road in Easton. And that's nice to see that something successful is coming. You just thought that Occupy Bristol had disappeared. Well, you're wrong.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, getting to the root of the financial crisis, London-based Islamic think tank Global Vision 2000 has been doing some thought-provoking excavations, and I spoke to the director, Moeen Yassin.
My name is Moeen Yassin, and I'm the founder director of Global Vision 2000. It's a private Islamic think tank and consultancy. Given what's been happening both here in the West, we're going deeper into an abyss, dare I say, and also the Islamic world. Somebody said interesting times, maybe interesting, but dangerous times too.
Now, there seems to be a bit of a problem in Europe, doesn't there? It's a constant, week after week, we're getting the same news. There's a crisis conference and nothing is really resolved. Now, as someone that predicted the financial crisis really before it happened in 2008, can you look over the horizon and explain why we're in the situation we are and where we may be headed?
Well, recently in London, the monetary reform movement, if I may call it that, I attended James Quilligan's special tour in London. I asked him where we were at, because he's one of these top thinkers who has advised various people like Willy Brandt, and he's also working on the global commons theory about ending the privatization of the global commons, reversing that. Basically, he thinks a bigger crash is on the horizon. And I asked him when, He said 5-10 years.
Now, there's something wrong with interest. Many, all the major religions agree on that, that it transfers wealth from the poor to the rich, a sort of Robin Hood in reverse, in a way. Is there some sort of, do you think, an end to that? I mean, what happens when the poor simply have got no more money to pay?
Well, of course, usury is been condemned historically, as you said, quite rightly. One of the reasons is it's also philosophical, not just practical. Philosophically, money is not a commodity, as it is in the current system, but a means of exchange, like air, literally. Why should one individual or cartel monopolize that? And inevitably, that will lead to debt, poverty, and the road to serfdom, as David Pidcock and other writers have talked about. And unfortunately, we are beginning to see the destitution beginning to happen in Europe and America, and all this glamour, glitz of, you know, our society, once you get rid of it and see what's really going on, and the media doesn't show it really, unless it has to, this crash is beginning to bite into the real economy and real lives.
You've also said that you think that when you have your meetings in the Islamic military reform people, and, you know, spreading out to a wider Islamic community, that you start with a prayer. I mean, what is that prayer and why do you do that?
I've done that not recently, but consciously in the past. And indeed, I'm taking the work to a different level. I'll explain that in the last year, what I've been doing spiritually, given the crisis, spiritual meditation in a big group. But coming back to the opening of paradigm shift events, including in the House of Commons, I deliberately start with A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In plain speaking English, it means, well, it's in the Quran basically. All chapters start with it. So I'm just imitating it, but I'm doing it in a public forum. Basically, that verse means, I seek refuge from the Satan, and in the name of the Lord, the Most Beneficial, the Merciful. But I have used a bit of interpretation to say I don't just seek refuge from Satan, but by definition, satanic forces. And I think, in a nutshell, the problem of economics started with Cain and Abel, you know, the fight between the two brothers. We are up against satanic forces, influences and forces in the real world. I've come to the conclusion that not just that there are satanic forces and powers to be reckoned with, to be dealt with, but also we need to change the manpower. We've got to get rid of people, basically, in institutions of power and replace them. So prayer, I'm afraid, is not enough. People who want social change, and my model is Moses, Abraham, Muhammad, Jesus, we got to change these institutions by changing the people. Okay, there might be some good people there, but we did a couple of seminars in the House of Lords last year on the Arab Spring and stolen money. But the last one I did was outside St. Paul's Cathedral, where they occupy. We need to identify not just the 1%. The more I think about it, it's a couple of 100,000 individuals who really call the shots.
So that's like the 0.001%, something like that?
Well, of course, there may be others who are colluding in different ways. But those who call, and I'll mention names, and we have to. You know, when I say a couple of hundred, a couple of thousand, people like Rothschild and his henchmen, they're not clean. They got blood on their hand. We need to also look at their henchmen, you know, who else execute their policies, manage their policies.
We're in a bit of a problem, aren't we, because we're going more into austerity. Do you think that the money power that's controlled by these big people like the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, that they're actually using that basically to bribe people towards their point of view? Because the fact that people are starting to get hungry, they're losing their benefits, disabled people are dying, that there's a kind of motivational force behind that money.
The European heads of prime ministers, or, you know, heads of states, they're all manipulated by the puppet masters, and the real people who call the shots are the masters of the universe, as someone called them, yeah, financial oligarchs. The system is bankrupt. I said that in 2008, even in House of Lords seminar. We've had a L-shaped depression. And all the signs are they've been manipulating interest rates like LIBOR has come out in the open, the stock market for that matter, and the unemployment figures, yeah. All the evidence is that they've been manipulating, yeah, all the key economic, yeah, levers. I believe there has been an L-shaped, not even double dip, but crash. We're still there. And the solution that has been imposed, if that's the word, through the governments and policies, is adding to the problem. The austerity by basically so-called quantitative easing, printing money, but basically they are cutting, yeah, the real economy. It's like less blood in a body. By reducing the circulation of money, by cutting, is going to worsen the problem.
Okay, what's the solution in a nutshell then, from the Global Vision 2000 point of view?
Well, we've said on wherever we can, in TV or public meetings, one, you've got to cancel all these debts. Basically a clean sheet, and this is, as other people have said in the past, monetary reform was the Jubilee, yeah, solution. It's so bad, forget austerity. We've got to admit the situation, as someone said, even spiritually, is uncontrollable, and people are being killed by the current austerity policies. We've got to demand a stop to austerity globally. That means these so-called monetary numerical figures of debt need to be burnt, or the claims of debt by whoever have got to be burnt. They've got to be basically cancelled, to use neutral language. Secondly, we got to devise a publicly accountable monetary and financial system. The monetary and financial system has got to be in publicly accountable institutions. And finally, I don't think it's enough. We got to, as I said at the beginning of this conversation, identify those who are and were pulling the financial levers of power, identify them, put a case for their criminality, you know, their crimes, and they've got to be basically prosecuted. Unless we do that, these jokers or Draculas will come back and haunt us again.
Oh, that was-